Bishus the Rav Shlita. First of all, thank you to the Rav Shlita, thank you Shaya, to Avi Stern for ensuring and facilitating the ability for the shit to take place. May this base medrash, this bias in Megalim by Torah Tefillah continue to thrive with the Frischkeit, same Frischkeit it's had for as many years as I remember it. May it continue to be a vision to all the other Bottom Midrashim in Manchester and in England. And I thank my corporate sponsors for the event tonight, RYBM Scaffolding and Aston's Law. Thanks to all other sponsors who help the Koil operate and all our Shutfim in Zachas HaTorah. I'd like to thank Mr. Burst for his warm words of introduction. And last but not least, Yisrael Meir Shasti for organizing yet another, putting his kochos and efforts into organizing yet another event, another shiur. The supposed to speak tonight, these days, as we approach the Me'astichus of Neroyim, we know Chazal tell us, the amount a person's income is determined, preordained from 1 year of Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah. One says further, the same way as income is determined, the expenditure is also predetermined. One of those does say that zocha, there are different ways that a person can have his expenditure and different ways of income. Zocha's expenditure is spent on stocker and aniyim, on schusim, lo zocha gets taken away from him in other ways. So essentially, the income and expenditure for the year is predetermined. Of course, we have to do our hishtadlus. Of course, we live under b'zeis apecha teichalecha, we can't ignore it. But the attitude has to be that of the Oichle Hamon, as Naveen would take out the Tenes Hamon and say, you're not learning because you have to. You need panosa. You know, Hamadif lohebeve, Hamamet lohechse, the amount of hishtadlus you do is unrelated. And when a person has that perspective, it sheds an entirely different attitude and approach to some of the scenarios that I'd like to share. The topic of tonight is the title was Brokers, Agents, and Flippers. When the middleman navigating circumstances, situations when the middleman alters the deal. And just give a doma in way of introduction, in the light of what we just said, that what we're dealing with is situations where there isn't full transparency, there isn't full disclosure. When there's full transparency, when there's disclosure of what's going on, everyone is aware of what's happening behind the scenes, there is no behind the scenes, then the questions don't become questions, the shyness don't become shyness, everyone knows, everyone agrees, it's done, it's mutually accepted, and there's no dispute. The situations arise very often when people are unaware what's going on. And then it becomes a question of how do we deal it and how do we tackle it. And it becomes relevant for the several different angles why it's relevant when it becomes relevant. Number one is, if someone acts as a middleman between a buyer and a seller, he sees something is coming on the market for sale, and he sees it's a good deal, and he sees someone wants to buy it, and he knows he can have a good deal. And yes, he has an ayin tova. Mr. Burst will give you an ayin tova. Let Charles get his wonderful deal. Let the seller get a wonderful deal. But why can't I also have an ayin tova to me also? I can also be happy. I can also make something on the side. The seller will get a good price. The buyer will get a good price. And I'll also get my cut. And everyone will be happy. So what's the chef? What's wrong with that? So now, the question is, if he's a broker, and he's charging a brokerage fee, so now he's come along, his job is really to connect two people together, and he's come along and he's done something else in between as well. Besides connecting the people deal, he's altered the price in the fee. So now, question number one is, has he done his job? He's supposed to provide, let's say he's acting as the broker for the buyer. So he's supposed to find a property for the buyer, and he's supposed to act in the interest of the buyer, provide him a house, get him the best price, get him a good deal, get him to do what he can, and for that he takes a commission. That's what he's being paid for. Now he's gone, and he's taking his own cut, so he's not provided the service that he's charging for. So we have to now assess and say, 1 minute, maybe you don't get a brokerage fee. Another angle is, a person may well turn around and say, well listen, I only agreed to buy that house for that price because I thought that's what the sale price was. Had I known that the seller was selling it for less and you're making money in between, I wouldn't be muscling to buy it on those terms. So make a thought. Conversely, you can have the same from the seller's position. The seller could say, I only agreed to sell it for that price, so I thought that was the best price we could achieve. Had I known that you were making something on the side, and in theory I could have made a better price here, I wouldn't agree to sell it for the price I agreed. So both the seller and the buyer might have an angle where they want to void the sale. A third point, which is the primary point I want to discuss, is really, who does this money belong to? See, I have a situation where somebody's charged money and the buyer thinks he's paying for the house, the seller thinks he sold his house for the full price, and the person in the middle is taking some cut. Who does that cut actually belong to? Now, there's various possible suggestions you can put forward. Some might say, well, we should split it 50-50. Some might say, it belongs to the buyer. Some might say, well, it belongs to the seller. Some might say, no, it belongs to the agent. The seller agreed to sell it for that. The buyer agreed to buy it for that. So that's what I'm taking. That's my fee. And then, there's a further, more sophisticated argument, perhaps, that a person might claim there arises a claim under the heading of professional negligence. That you're paying a professional, you're paying somebody to provide you with a service. Now, in theory, he could have done a better service for you. And therefore, you look at what he's provided for you, and you say, well, I've had a loss. Had you provided the service in the way that you should have, I would have had more money. I would be able to recover more gains. Therefore, you considered professionally negligent, and that might be basis for a claim. Now, to give more of some more flesh and bones to these questions, I relate some scenarios, and these are true scenarios. So the first scenario is somebody asks an agent to sell his house, and the agent says to him, how much would you like to achieve for the sale of your house? He says, I've done my research and this house should achieve £250,000. Comes back to him a number of weeks later, and he says, I've got good news for you. I've got a buyer for your house. I've managed to find a buyer, someone who's willing to pay $270,000. I says, wow, that's amazing, fantastic. And he says, and you wanted to sell it $250,000, right? You agreed to sell it $250,000, right? Okay, so we're selling it for $270,000. I think we should split that $20,000. So he says, 1 second. Whose house is selling? Is it your house or my house? Yeah, it's your house, but you're selling it for $250,000. So I've got you more money than you wanted. So let's share that. It's your house. I got it. Let's split it. And we might see, he might even be able to cite a paragraph, a source, to reference why he should be entitled to 50-50. And why not? You're willing to serve $250,000. The second case, the second story was, person is schmoozing, talking informally with a friend of his, and he says, I've had my eye on that property for a long time. If I could get hold of that property for 300,000, I'm telling you it's Mama Shachap. If that goes for 300,000, it's Mama Shachap. Yeah. As it happens, he bumps into the landlord of the house, and the landlord says, I'm a bit strapped for cash right now. I've got cash flow issues. I need to liquidate some assets. If you know anyone who's willing to take this property off me, I'll give it away for 250. So he thinks to himself, listen here, I've got somebody who's willing to buy for 300. I've got somebody who's willing to sell for 250. I'll sort it out. I'll get him his house for 250. I'll buy a house for 300. They'll both be happy. And I'll work out what to do with the other 50. Don't worry. These are true stories. I don't know if he used that wording or not, but the situation was true story. Another situation was from the investor side. The fellow had money to invest, and he had £50,000 to invest, and he asked somebody to buy him or get him some buy-to-let property. And the fellow bought him a buy-to-let property, the tenant got his return, going on. He was so happy, he sent him another £50,000, got him another buy-to-let property. After a number of years, he got hold of the land registry documents, and he sees on the land registry documents that this house was sold, the seller had sold it for £30,000 and not £50,000. Both the two houses had been sold for £20,000 less than he had paid. So he calls up his fellow and he says, what's going on? You bought the house, it was £30,000. There may have been some costs, refurbishment, something. Like, give me a breakdown of the costs and I'll pay you back, but I want the change. So the fellow says to him, I'm an agent. I'm not an agent. I've never been a broker in my life. My business is I buy properties, I refurbish them, I put in a tenant, and then I sell them on. And that's what happened. I bought this property, yes, I bought it for £30,000. I refurbished it, I put in a tenant, and I sold you a redone property with a tenant in for £50,000. That's what I do. In another situation, I don't know if this one's true, it's more anecdotal, but it just shows the same principles, it shares the same yesodus in a completely different setting, and these questions do occur more frequently than one thing. People say to me, you know, in England this can't happen, there's solicitors, there's lawyers, it's written down, there's contracts. I'm telling you these things happen, they're ma'asim b'chol yom, they're ma'asim shehoyu, ma'asim are going to happen again. If you want to know how can it happen, I can tell you after the shiur how it happens. Normally, the first warning sign is if somebody says there's a property for sale, this is the price, but 20,000 of that price has to be in cash and it's not going to be on the contract. That's normally the first warning sign something's going on. Okay, another anecdote is there was a fellow selling sforim, and he put a pile of sforim outside the shul with a pushka and the price. Put out a pile of 10 sforim, and it's £9 or safer. He's going to sell all his 10 sforim, get £90 in the box, and that's what he wants. Somebody came along, and he took the sign which said £9 on, and he replaced it with a sign which said £10 on. So everyone comes along and buys the safer, they put £10 in the box. After 9 sforim have been sold, there's £90 in the box. Says, fine, the guy's got his £90 that he wants, and he walks off with a tenth safer. Again, we have a situation, we have a buyer and a seller, and we have a middleman, unauthorized, has come and altered the terms of the sale. Now, the approach to analyze and distill these questions are going to be on the definition of the middleman. What is he? Is he a shliach? Translated loosely in English, is an agent. Agent in English is a wide ranging term, but every system has common to all systems a way of somebody else authorizing somebody else. You give them over power of attorney, you appoint somebody else to act in your place. That is what a shliach is. A shliach shluchei shel adam kamoisei. It's as if the person himself is standing here. When you appoint a shliach, that's the person himself is standing here. The person himself is doing the deal. When you have an agent in the terms of translated as a shliach, he's the one affecting the sale. In contrast, you have a broker. A broker's job is not affecting the sale. He's not the buyer, he's not the seller. His job is to connect two people together. You have somebody he wants to buy, you have somebody he wants to sell, I put you together, and he gets his fee for connecting those two people. But the buyer is doing the buying, the seller is doing the selling, the buyer is buying from the seller, the seller is selling to the buyer. But the man in the middle isn't doing anything other than facilitating the sale of those two parties. So he's not actively involved as a part of the sale. And then we have people who buy and sell. They will buy it with an eye to make a profit by flipping this profit on, by selling this profit on. And then you have people who are just unauthorized mavericks. They're not brokers, they're not flippers, they're not agents, they just come along and alter something totally unauthorized. So now, if we look at the sources for this, there are a number of sources which are relevant. We have a case which is brought in Shulchan Aruch and Hilchos Shluchim of a shliach who sent to buy something. Somebody gives somebody money, go along and purchase a kilo of wheat and gives him the money, goes by from there. And the vendor threw in something extra. So he's used somebody else's money to effect a purchase, which he's instructed to do so. And as a result of that, he's now the recipient of some additional bonus. Who does that belong to? So the Shulchan Aruch passes in that case. Okay. It has to be split between the buyer and the Shia. They're both entitled to an equal share. 50-50. But there seems to be a discrepancy. There seems to be a discrepancy. Because there's another case which is brought down just a number of simonim apart, where somebody hands over an item of his to sell. He gives him this item, he says, please do me a favor, liquidate this item for me, I would like to achieve a price of four for this item, four, or zuz, four, shkolim, whatever he's talking about over there, I'd like to achieve four for the sale of this item. And the shliach takes it to the market, and he finds a buyer for six. The difference of two belonged to the seller. He sold the item. Seller says, I'm happy at four for it. But he sold it for six. He did more than he was instructed to do. He went over and beyond. He achieved a higher price. That money belongs to the person whose item it was instructed to sell. So we're left with a problem. We have to reconcile these two halachos. On the one hand, a bonus that he receives, he can split. On the other hand, he sells the item for more. He has to return that to the person who sent him. And these two halachos are based on the Gemara in Kesubas. The Gemara in Kesubas makes a distinction. The Gemara is based on a Mishnah. And the Mishnah says, an almono. Almono is entitled to claim her Kesubah. Her Kesubah is 200 zuz. And she seized an asset from the Yisraelim, who she's claiming from, worth 100. And she sold that asset for 200. So she took something which was worth a mono, which was worth 100, she sold it for 200, says the Gemara, says the Mishnah, kibla kusubasa. The obligation to pay her ksuba has been discharged, she's got 200, so she received 200. She can't turn around and say, well, I only took something which was worth 100 from you. I need another 100 now. I sold it for 200, not your business. No. So the Gemara says, how do we reconcile that with the halacha of shliach, who receive the bonus, you have to split it. So the Gemara says there's a distinction between a dova kotsuv and a dova she'ina kotsuv. A dova kotsuv means something which has a fixed set price, and a dova she'ina kotsuv means something which has a variable price. And we'll first explain what the difference is. So when you have an item which has not got a fixed price, so then the price that is agreed, that becomes the sale price. So you have a piece of land, it's worth a mono, but it's not got a fixed price. Some people pay more, some people pay less. You go and sell it for 200, so the land has been sold for 200. You take an item that belongs to somebody, he's asked you to sell it for four, but you sell it for six. So it's a dollar shame, because you couldn't cheat, some people pay more, some people pay less for it. So then, you've taken the item, you've made the terms of the sale in such a way that the sale is now considered to be that price that you've established for it. Where you have a dova kotsuv, where Everybody sells a kilo of flour for the same price. A kilo of grain has a set price. And he comes on to the store and he says, I'd like to buy a kilo of grain. Here's the money. And the storekeeper says, oh, here's a kilo of grain. Take a sweet. Take a candy. Take something extra. He throws it in something which is clearly not part of the sale. It's a gift. It's a bonus. But it's not part of the sale. Why? The sale has got very clear, defined terms. The sale for a kilo of grain, you know what it is. He says, take this as an extra, take this as a gift. So now, you have to deal with that gift. It's not part of the sale. What do you do? So one says, okay, why do you divide it into two? The Machlokes Rishonim. Rashi says, because it's unclear who this gift was intended for. Was it intended for this person who wanted to give a gift? Hey, take a candy. You came into my store, get a candy. No, you bought a kilo of wheat. So fine, I'd like to give you a gift. It's unclear. Other Rishonim say, the reason is because it's like a joint venture. The way the gift was achieved was using the money, using the deal of the sale of the grain, he gave you a gift. He says, yeah, but I'm the one who did this deal. I'm the one who facilitated that this should happen. So therefore, it's like a joint venture. I'm using your money to get something extra, which is not part of the sale. So therefore, we have a shutvus in it. And therefore we split it. The nafkamina is, what happens if the storekeeper says, here, take this gift, it's for you. So now we've got no sofek of who it was intended for, but nonetheless it was achieved through the joint venture. Okay. But that essential distinction is very important to understand. That when something is part of the sale, then the shliach doesn't have a claim to it. When it's not part of the sale, it's an additional bonus, then he has a claim to half of it. And possibly, if it's clear that it was intended for him, he may have a claim for the whole thing. There is a converse case. What happens, there's also a common scenario. Somebody sends somebody to buy something in the store, and he comes to the store, and he finds this item is reduced. Normal price is this, and this was the person who sent it was unaware. Now the item is reduced. What happens to the change? So, the halacha talks about a case where somebody had a debt that needed to be paid off. He owed money. He had a debt of £100,000. And he asked his friend to go pay off his debt. Give him £100,000. Do me a favor. Go pay off the debt for me. I can't face him. You pay him off for me. Slept long enough. Go pay him back. Give him £100,000. Go pay him back. So he comes to him and Shiklach Heberman, and he says to him, you know, Yenna owes you £100,000. For months he's not paid you back. Yeah? Give him a bit of a break. Yeah, take 80. They'll sort it out. Get it. Take 80,000 and call it a day. I said, you know, if I'd get £80,000, you know, they'll pay me £80,000. He says, you know, here's £80,000. He said, that's his enough. So who does that £20,000 of change which is sitting in his pocket? Who does that belong to? Says the halacha, it belongs to the mishaleach, to the person who sent him. Says that money was always his money. The ownership of that money was his. It was his money sitting in somebody else's pocket. There never was any transfer of ownership. There was never any title change on that money. Nothing was affected. It's my money sitting in your pocket. Now, you didn't need to use all my money because he was willing to give a break for 80,000. Fine. So now you've got £20,000 of my money sitting in your pocket. So those are the principles which are clearly, those cases are clear, they're written in the halakha, and those are the principles that need to be applied and understood in order to approach these different types of cases. So if we have somebody who is really a shliach, genuinely a shliach, to sell a property, he has power to tell you to sell somebody else the property, and he says to somebody, how much do you want to sell a property for? And he's told the price. And he goes and adds a figure to that price. So now, when he tells the buyer, this is the price of the property, it's true, this is now the price of the property. because he's a shliach. He's authorized to determine the details of the sale. He's authorized to say, these are the terms of the purchase. You want to buy it, this is the price. Who are you? I'm a shliach. I am the vendor. So if I told you this is the price, and now the buyer pays that full price, and then the seller discovers what's going on. The seller is attempting to say, that money belongs to me. You sold my property for a higher price. It's as if you've taken my item, which I asked you to sell for four in the market. I made you a shliach to sell it for four, and you sold it for six. It's not a difference if it's an item is an item or if it's a house. It doesn't make a difference if I asked you to sell it for 200 or for four. It doesn't make a difference if you ordered it to six or for 220. The fact is, you sold my item for more. Now, what happens though if he wasn't an agent? He was a broker. And somehow he managed to convince and extract more money out of a buyer. Now, the seller becomes aware and he says, that money that you extracted out of the buyer, that belongs to me. On the same logic. You sold my house for more money. So here it's not so straightforward. It's not so straightforward. Because the broker wasn't authorized on the terms of the sale. He wasn't authorized to determine the price of the purchase. He's a broker. He's putting the buyer and the seller together. So they're very... Well, could be a strong argument to say that purchase price was that which was determined by the vendor. The buyer who bought the house and gave more money, truly he was willing to pay more money for the house. That was because he was misled to think that the purchase price is higher than it really is. He is giving that money because he believes that's the purchase price. But now he discovers that that's not the purchase price. The purchase price is in fact lower. Okay, so the money which I gave for the purchase price, which is really the purchase price, to pass that on to the vendor, and the money which I gave for the purchase price, which isn't really for the purchase price, return that to me. Now, very often what happens is the middleman, rightly or wrongly, knowingly or unknowingly, dresses himself up as being a buyer and a seller. And he says that I bought it and I sold it on. And it's possible to do such arrangements. But the question is, did you do that arrangement? Well, how do I know? He says he did. He says he didn't. So the first question we'll take to him is, first of all, did you charge a broker fee? When you buy something and sell something, you don't charge a broker fee. Yeah? If you're charging a broker's fee, vice versa, you're not the buyer, you're not the seller, you're brokering a buyer and a seller. Second question I ask is, whose money did you use to purchase the property? If you're using his money to purchase the property, and then you're selling it to him and taking his money, how does that work? You can't use his money to purchase the property because you're selling a property which you haven't yet bought. Although, as it doesn't always necessarily work as straightforward as that. Now the question is, what are the terms of your sale and your purchase? Every sale has terms, there's terms of the sale, terms of the purchase. So you say you bought it and you sold it. So under what terms did you buy it? Under what terms did you sell it? But most importantly of all is because sometimes you have a situation where people can do a back-to-back. They do a simultaneous exchange and completion. And they sell it on the same day, and again they do a simultaneous exchange and completion. So therefore, what that means is, and they use the same solicitors to do both transactions. So what that means is, money comes into the solicitor's account, and that money is going out on the solicitor's account, okay, all the same solicitor's account. So therefore, I can use the same money for exchange and completion. It doesn't have to be that the fact that I didn't transfer any money is not necessarily going to be indication of whether there was a purchase and a sale going on again, because I didn't need to transfer any money for it in order to do it, because the solicitors were willing to do it all based on the fact they had the money in their account. They knew that money was going forwards and backwards, and therefore they were happy to do both transactions. The question is, the underlying question is, who's taking responsibility for the sale? What happens is that problem with the purchase. Later on, the buyer finds a defect in the house. He finds the problem and he wants to sue the seller. He wants to make a claim against the seller. Who does he go back to? Does he go back to the middleman or does he go back to the seller of the house? If the middleman is really the buyer and the seller, that means he's going to be implicated and he's going to have to take responsibility for the sale to the final buyer. And very often the people will say one of two things. He'll say like this. Number one, I got you a sale price. You should know 2%, brokers charge 2%. No broker that charges 2% would have done the work that I did to get you this price. Do you know what I did to get you this price? I put it in the advertiser, I put it on social media, I put on my status, I put on my wife's status. I did this, that, and that. I ran it all over to get everyone else to put on their status. I made a special offer, a special raffle, free whiskey if you put on your status. Eventually, I got that price. No one would have driven us so much sugar for 4 weeks to get that price. You're paying me 2%, you expect me not to get that price? And the answer to that is that doesn't entitle you to take the money. You may have a claim. You may be able to say, don't forget, if he achieves a higher price, that pushes up his commission as well. So he's getting 2% of the higher price as well. But he says, even so, even for 2% higher price, it's still not worth it. You know how much effort and the sugar went. It's okay, it's true. So you might be entitled to get recompensated for the work that you did. We'll have to assess what's normal salary to pay somebody to promote your thing on a sugar item. So that you're entitled to. And you'll have to also contribute a share to that because you're getting your 2% benefit, you're getting a benefit for that. So that might be. But that does not entitle you to say, oh, I can take the money. And the other argument people put forward is, well, I could have even bought the house. I had the cash. At that time, I could have purchased the house. I would have purchased the house. And had I known that I'm only getting 2%, I definitely would have bought the house and sold on the house. And the answer to that is, you could have, you would have, and you should have, but you didn't. If you didn't do it, you didn't do it. You're not the buyer, you're not the seller, you can't take the money. So the fact that you could have done it, the fact that you have a minion that could have done it, doesn't help you. What's coming across my plate more commonly and more frequently now is the questions of rent to rent. You have scenarios where you have a managing agent, and he manages a property for somebody, it's a buy-to-let property, and he rents it out. Now, he becomes aware, because he's a managing agent and he deals with these things, he knows that there's housing associations or councils, they pay a market rate, which is far above a normal market rent. And most people can't approach them, but he deals with so many properties, he can approach them. So he rents it out to one of these housing associations, but he doesn't pass that on to the landlords. Under the logic, you say, listen, the landlord is happy to get the regular rent. I give him a market rent, maybe a bit higher. And he's happy with it, the landlord's happy, he's unaware. But in fact, he's actually renting out the property. And what does he say? He says, well, I can rent it out for that price. He'll be happy to rent it to me for that price. So I'm renting it out for him for that price. And then I'll rent it out to the housing association for the higher price, and I'll make the profit. So here, there's 2 points. Number one is, the same thing, he's charging a managing agent's fee on the rental that he's supposedly paying. Number one is, you haven't rented it, you haven't leased it. You don't have a contract in place between yourself and the landlord. Again, if there's financial transparency or full disclosure, it's not an issue. You tell the landlord, listen here, I'm renting out to a housing station. You can't do that. I can do that. I get this rent. You get this rent. I make my property, make your profit. There's not a problem. The problem is the landlord's unaware. So in effect, you've gone and you've taken his property and you've rented out his property. So that money that comes in is rent for his property. You've rented his property to the housing association. Number two is even if a person does sign a residential lease, you have to be aware of whether that entitles him to lease out to a person to the housing station. Often they put in the chevra they put in are people you wouldn't want, or for instance, they do HMOs or whatever they're doing. But does the under the terms of the lease, are you entitled to lease out to one of these to one of these sort of chevra? Does your if you claim that you are a rental and you've been bought lease interface and you're not charging a commission because you're the one renting it, so if you're not entitled to rent it, then again, it's Rabbuna Halacha that if you rent out a property for usage that you're not entitled to use yourself, then the rental for that, the increased rental for that usage belongs to the landlord. I hope I've been able to clarify some of the points, some of the halachas, and Rabbi Shem should help. Tachol Shono Bechasel, all the images of the Hanas, and maybe all these zayfot to be a skill fed at the very meaning.